From the Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com. Very pleasant good morning to you. This is Patrick Timpone, and you've got OneRadioNetwork.com. It's a nice morning here, Central Texas. A little cool breeze in the air before we get to 95. That's great. Okay, next hour, Brandon Amalani, and he's a Chinese medicine guy. We're going to talk about yin and yang and balance in Chinese medicine and diet and all kinds of things. We'll have fun learning more about our body. Yes. Yeah. Thursday, breaking the chains of obesity. Yeah. Well, we could use some of that in this country. And a little bit about numerology. That's fun. I haven't talked about that for a few years. In the numbers. Tomorrow, Andrew Goss and the Real World of Money. If you'd like to be on the show, our phone lines are always open. 888-663-6386 and email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Last Wednesday, I believe it was Wednesday, we put up a study that was done by lead researcher Dr. Judy Carman in Adelaide, Australia. Howard Vlieger, who's been on the show before, there were two of, I think four or five people involved in this study trying to determine if GMO grains and feed affect animals. And Dr. Carman is on the line. She is in Adelaide. She's an epidemiologist, a biochemist. Her website is gmojudycarman.org. Adjunct professor at Flinders University in Adelaide. Also studied organic chemistry, PhD in medicine, nutritional biochemistry, master of public health, and director of the Institute for Health and Environmental Resources. So when she's not chasing kangaroos, you look like you're doing a lot of research and work, Dr. Carman. How are you?
Thank you. I'm very good. Hello from Australia.
Yeah.
Hello, Texas.
Yeah, and how are all the kangaroos? Do they eat GMO food?
Usually not. They just eat, if a farmer's growing a GM crop in a paddock, I imagine they would come in and eat it like they do many other crops. But we don't actually grow very much in the way of GM crops in Australia. We grow a bit of GM canola and some GM cotton, but most of the crops grown in the US are soy and corn, and we don't grow those over here.
Uh-huh. And Howard Vlieger, Howard is president of Verity Farms. He's a farmer, he's a researcher, GMO activist, Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, and has been doing quite a bit of work in the field of GMOs. Howard, how are you?
Good morning. Good. Past president, that would be, of Verity, we have a beautiful day here in Northwest Iowa this morning.
Northwest Iowa. Judy Carman, how did you all meet, hook up, and become mates?
Yes, we should explain what mate is, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
Mate is an Australian term that means buddy in American, so yes. Howard had been seeing adverse effects in pigs for some time, and because he's a farm advisor, he was regarded that some of these problems might be due to the pigs eating, pigs and cattle eating GM crops.
Mm-hmm.
So he would advise people to take the animals off GM crops and the problems would disappear, and then when they put the animals back on GM crops, the problems would come back. He was wanting to work with someone to investigate this properly, and as a result of he and I both knowing the same person in the US, he and I had a phone conversation about the situation and how we could investigate it. And as a result of that, we got a research group together and we did the work on pigs in Iowa.
Oh, in pigs in Iowa. So, Howard,
yes,
how What kind of things have you been seeing, and when did it start for you with animals being fed GM corn and soy and such?
We did our first research back when it was still legal to do side-by-side research in field on GM corn in 1997. And we repeated that same research in 1998 because we had just the opposite results of what we were told would happen when you planted BT corn. We lost money. It cost us $55 plus an acre both years. And when we offered that BT corn to the cattle in a small test, we put conventional corn and BT corn in the opposite ends of the feed bunk and put a couple cows in there, and they ate the conventional corn and smelled the BT and walked away from it. So we thought, well, that's sure not normal. And all of the experiences from there going forward of all of the farmers that we worked with in all the different states across the country were consistent. When they were observant to what was happening and what was going on, and the ones that had the segregated grain, they would have the first year they planted a GMO, they put that in one bin and had the conventional in another. Well, every time they fed the GMO version, whether it was BT at first or later the herbicide-tolerant crops, they were consistently seeing different issues in animal health. And as the thing progressed and we saw more and more adoption of the GM grain, many of the problems that were being experienced by the bulk of the livestock producers were pretty much being noted broad scale. Everybody had the same problem. So the issue with that was that many people began to call that normal, and that was not the case. And with all of the things that we had saw, at that time I was doing quite a bit of work with Dr. Elaine Ingham, and I was identifying the problems as circumstantial or coincidental, and she said, no, Howard, it's anecdotal. Now take it to the next level and get the scientific parameters in place and do the study and to really back it up. And thankfully that was, from that, was able to meet up with Judy, and we were able to get the study put together and prove what we suspicioned was happening all along. Hmm.
So, Dr. Carmen, the study began when? How long did it last?
It was a while ago. It was, not this year. It was a little bit longer ago than that. But the pigs were fed for their entire commercial lifespan. So basically the first solid food they ate, once they were weaned, they were randomized into two groups. One was fed the GM diet. The other group was fed the non-GM diet as a control.
Mm-hmm.
And their entire commercial lifespan, which was over 5 months, that's what they ate. And then at the end of that process, they were killed, as normally happens in pigs at that age. They went to an abattoir, as we would call it here, a slaughterhouse, I think you call it there.
Mm-hmm.
They were just processed through as normally. But we got the entrails from those pigs, and we had a really good look through the entrails. And that's when we found these problems in the pigs.
Oh, so the study was done in Australia?
No, the study was done in Iowa.
In Iowa? Huh.
Yes, I came out to Iowa and experienced an Iowan winter.
Oh, good for you. And how
we
long?
Referred to her as the Australian popsicle on occasion because she was not liking our weather.
Yes, it was. I came out there with a coat, and Howard looked at this coat and said, Judy, that ain't a coat. And I had some experience at that point that it was likely to get cold.
That's not a coat. And how long were you in Iowa?
A month, I think.
I see.
3 or 4 weeks.
I see. So, and how many pigs were involved?
168, I think, from memory.
Uh-huh.
So we had a nice sample size there, which means what the industry tends to do if they do a toxicology study on rats, usually, or animals like that, they often have very few numbers of animals in each group, which means it's actually very difficult to find statistical significance between the GM and the non-GM fed groups, because you just don't have what's called the statistical power to be able to pick it up. So you might be having some significant things going on, but you can't pick it up statistically. So that's why we had so many pigs, was so that by the time you split 168 pigs into GM and non-GM fed, and then split them again into, you know, males and females, you still had enough numbers of pigs there to be able to pick up biologically significant findings as a statistically significant result.
And that's part of your training and education. This whole idea of how to do studies and what are real studies and all that kind of stuff, right? That's what you part of your education, right? In your PhD.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, PhD and also in the Masters. And also I've taught research methods and taught statistical methods to students. And so I've got a pretty good idea by this stage how to actually do it.
Yeah.
And I can also look at the way the industry does their studies and go, you do what? In reply.
And then, Howard, how do you control during the 5 months that what the study is trying to show is done correctly? In other words, they're kept in groups and they're fed this and nothing else and all of that.
We had a very complete and complex protocol that was written out in advance of doing the study, and we followed that to the T. There were the only individual who knew which pigs were which was the person that was actually making the feed for them and putting the feed in the feeders. All of the rest of the people that were involved in different duties of the study had no idea which group was which. They were all blinded as to what pigs were what, and that way it was as unbiased as it could be. And the same thing followed through when we did the harvest of the animals and the autopsy and necropsy work. The veterinaries had no idea which group had been fed what feed, as well as the people that were collecting or handling, I should say, the viscera. None of them knew what was what. The only two people that knew was Dr. Carmen and myself.
Very interesting. So then I guess Dr. Carmen, go ahead.
And this is a really important thing, because the industry doesn't do that sort of control in the study. It's what's called a double-blind study, because the pigs obviously didn't know what they were eating, whether it was GM or non-GM. But the people who were doing the observational work, such as the veterinarians, would look at an organ and go, oh, this is wrong with that organ. They could have no, there was no bias coming out in their mind about what, you know, whether it was GM or non-GM. They had no idea. So therefore, they were completely unbiased in their observations.
So they would look at an organ and because of their training, they would know this is not right and what's not right about it. But they didn't know that particular pig had or had not had genetically modified feed, right?
That's absolutely correct. So
That's called double blind? That's called double blind?
That's called double blind, yeah. And that comes from randomized controlled trials for things such as pharmaceutical drugs that you would do on a human. So that, and they're some of the most thorough studies that you can do anywhere are the ones that epidemiologists do on people. And I just simply took the techniques from there and applied them to these pigs. So we had a very thorough protocol that we followed.
So, Howard, were these pigs also pastured, or were they just confined just to eat the GMO or the regular grain?
They were in what would be identified as somewhat of a typical environment for pigs, for the bulk of the pigs that are raised in our country today.
Okay. Typical meaning they'd get out a little bit and run around or whatever, but whatever.
Well, in the early phases, they were in raised nursery pens, and once they were through that, then they went into a grow finish facility, which is not typical. They had access to outdoors. In fact, it was an open front Cargill-style unit that they were housed in. We had the individual pens for each group and individual feeders, and everything was separated. And, it was that where the bulk of the mass-produced pork would be in total confinement. These had access to sunshine and the outdoors.
Mm-hmm. And what grains were they fed?
They were fed corn, non-GMO and GMO corn,
mm-hmm.
and then the soybeans were processed into soybean meal using a mechanical processing system, being an extruder-expeller process, which doesn't remove all of the oil like the industry standards do with the chemical or solvent extracted meal. And the reason we did that, it was the most feasible way for us to maintain the identity of the non-GMO soy and the GMO soy going through the handling chain to have everything accurate for which was which.
Oh, so process it as little as possible, really.
Well, it's mechanically processed where the extruder, basically they force the bean after grinding it, they force it through a very, very small opening,
mm-hmm.
which generates heat and it breaks down the trypsin,
mm-hmm.
so that the proteins can be digestible. Because a raw soybean, isn't digestible to any type of an animal. So, of course, the industry's practices of grinding the beans and then putting a carcinogen known as hexane into the meal, then that chemically extracts all of the oil from the meal. And that you could have a whole nother debate on the merits of that versus the process that we used.
Now, when you say GMO corn and GMO soy to the one control group, any particular kind? I guess there's different kinds of. In other words, if corn is GMO, it could be several different GMOs. Or I'm kind of confused on that. Some could be.
There was a combination of corn. It was triple stack corn, as well as triple stack, meaning it had two types of insecticide, one to kill the rootworm and one to kill the corn borer.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was also glyphosate tolerant, and mm-hmm. it was sprayed with a glyphosate herbicide. There was also there was a mixture in the bin from where the corn was derived. There was also the glyphosate tolerant and just BT, and then there was also a small amount of glyphosate corn. It would be a mixture, and in having that mixture, it was basically the real world approach.
That's what's out there in the real world. That kind of idea.
This is what the animals are eating. What is going to eventually end up in the food chain in varying forms.
Hmm.
It's the real world, what's out here, how's this going to affect everybody that is unknowingly consuming this, of course, as you know, because we're not afforded the courtesy of labeling.
Yeah. Okay, stay right there. We're going to take a quick little break here. If you have a question, you can jump in, 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. You can scroll down the page and look to last Wednesday when we published this study, and it went viral from our website, thousands of hits, and Dr. Judy Carman is the lead researcher, and then Howard Vlieger, who is with the Farm and Ranch Alliance, and Freedom Alliance. He was the past president, and he's a farmer and advocate, and then several other docs that we'll kind of find out about them were involved in this study. And also emails work, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. The head guy, the maker of this product we're going to tell you about, it's going to be on in 45 minutes. He is a Chinese medicine guy, and we're going to talk about Chinese medicine and how we can use some of those ideas with our particular healing. But this is Brandon and he's the Shizandra guy. Previously with Brandon on organic Shizandra containing the five tastes.
Bitter, sour, sweet, pungent, and salty. It's similar to the emotions that we were talking about last hour, you know, how like worry or pensiveness affected the spleen, like you were mentioning. Every taste affects one of the five organ systems, five yin organ systems, or one of the five elements. In Chinese medicine, you can basically condense all energy in the universe down to five elements, which is fire, earth, metal, water, wood. Because everything's interconnected, everything can just be distilled down into these five elements. So all five flavors, as they enter into your body, start sending signals to your organ systems to basically create a response or an effect.
The vibration or the information in the Shizandra.
Right, and that's why it's really key to have an energetically vital product that has all those five flavors and all the tastes.
Yes, indeed. They go through great lengths to get this Shizandra to you in amazing quality. Click and order right on the front page, Organic Shizandra, OneRadioNetwork.com. 21 minutes after the hour. It is a Tuesday morning. This is what I had for breakfast along with some colostrum. Mixed it up. I think it's good to get protein in the morning. More and more people tell us that. And this is a good choice other than having a fried pig or chicken or something. It's a good way to get protein, I think. Stephen Huer, One World Way guy, juicing vegetables and fruit. Surely that's all we need to do.
Fresh leafy greens and blend them up with fresh ripe fruit, and you've got yourself a highly pulverized, highly assimilable green fruit super smoothie for all of its antioxidants, alkalinizing, structured water, vitamin mineral benefits, but don't rely on it as a protein source. If you were born and raised from parents that were very, very health conscious and you have very good genetic code, very good digestive tract, you were breastfed and you have good GI tract development and good probiotic populations, you may be able to be so efficient at amino acid absorption that you need very small amounts of protein. You just got very efficient absorption. Most people born from the 50s, 60s forward have been compromised. They weren't breastfed. They were given antibiotics. They had damage in their gut from mercury from their dental fillings. And there's various different things that have made it so that they need more dense protein in their diet so they can assimilate enough amino acids to be a thriving human being.
Well, we want to be one of those, Stephen Huer. Lots are trying it. Maybe you'll try it for a month or two. Raw, grass-fed, One World Way. Front page, OneRadioNetwork.com. Chocolate, vanilla, strawberry. I would try, pick maybe two, your favorite chocolate or strawberry or something, of the smaller container and see how you do with it. Make sure you digest it well. Most people do. The great majority of people do. The casein lactose thing, there's no issue. Grass-fed, they actually have Amish farmers that I know, it's crazy, they do. That's where they get the milk from, which is pretty cool. The Amish people really, they really understand animals and the whole thing with farming. They get it. And then you can buy yourself a big 5-pound container and just get lots of good protein right on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com.
We are listener-supported. One Radio Network. Talk to Patrick now. 888-663-6386. Or email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com.
Dr. Judy Carman, lead researcher, and Howard Leger is on the line. And this, they wanted to try to find out exactly scientifically if the GMO grains were affecting the animals, as Howard was finding in the fields. I guess now, Howard, but 15 years or so, right? You've been...
Yeah, 1997.
Yeah, it's a long time.
And before that, I started actually studying GMOs in 94 before they were actually introduced, so... Was finding as much information online and as I could to learn about the process, and then started following the early research that came from tremendously skilled researchers in different parts of the world.
So, Dr. Carman, you said then you harvest all these pigs, I guess, what'd you say, 168 or something, and then that's when you came up, I guess, to Iowa. Is that right?
Yes, I came there at the end of the experiment. Yes, to because the main interest for me was the autopsies and what we might be able to actually see in the organs at autopsy. So I came over there and together, Howard and I set up the situation for the autopsies to occur, and we got the veterinarians together, and we did the autopsies.
How many veterinarians?
Took some blood.
We
had two. And yeah, we had two who were doing the autopsies, and that was really good because we actually split the work between the two. And in order to keep things consistent throughout the whole of the autopsy process, one veterinarian just concentrated on certain organs all the time, and the other one concentrated on the other organs all the time.
Hmm. So why do you just take the organs, the entrails, and not the meat? Look at the meat.
Well, the toxicology, you usually look at the entrails. You're usually interested in what happened in the liver and in the kidneys. And, of course, we had two main hypotheses that we were testing as a result of Howard's initial work from what he was seeing in happening in pigs and cattle. And that was that the two hypotheses were that GM foods cause cause reproductive problems in pigs,
mm-hmm.
and the other one was that it causes inflammation in the stomach and other digestive problems in pigs. So they were the two main ones that we were wanting to chase down to see if there was evidence for what Howard was seeing. And that's hard scientific evidence I'm talking about for what Howard was saying.
Right.
And the other thing, while we were there, we took lots of other measurements as well, just to see if there was anything else that we could see. And that involved a sort of standard biochemistry screen that you might get if you go to your doctor for a bit of a checkup. So we took those blood measurements too.
Uh-huh.
And the two hypotheses that we went there to really look at, the reproductive issues and the stomach inflammation, we proved both of them. We found that the uterus of the pigs fed the GM feed was increased in weight by 25%. And that was also statistically significant. So this is biologically significant because, you know, this can be associated with quite a few sort of nasty conditions, all of which have long names and all of which you don't want to get.
Yeah.
And
so let me see if I understand. And so scientifically, statistically, you can say as a scientist that the pigs that ate the GM, their uterus was 25%, they weighed 25% more than the non-GMO.
Yes, that's correct. And, and that could be due to a number of things, which includes things such as, you know, a thickening of the lining of the uterus, or it might polyps, or, you know, it might even be the beginnings of cancer or whatever. And obviously, you know, in the next study that's done, there should be, you know, tissues taken and actually looked at under a microscope just to see what's actually going on in the uteri of the pigs. But the other main thing we were interested in was to see if we could see if Howard's observation that there's an increase in stomach inflammation, whether we could prove that was the case or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we proved that one as well. So we had one veterinarian who was taking the stomachs from the pigs, slicing them open on the greatest curvature, it's called, and opening them up, washing out the contents, opening them up, and having a really good look at those stomachs. You know, he had a lamp on the stomachs, and he was looking at them, and you get little folds in the internal lining of the stomach. He was pulling those from one side to another, having a look behind them, and he was looking at ulcers to see if the number of ulcers or the severity of the ulcers was any higher in the GM-fed pigs, and also the level of stomach inflammation. And this veterinarian was blinded, as we've already said, so he didn't know which pig stomach in front of him, whether that pig had been fed GM or not. And he just graded the level of inflammation as either none, mild, moderate, or severe. And we found that there wasn't any difference in the number of ulcers produced in pigs that were fed the GM feed, but there was this significant difference, this significant increase in the amount of severe stomach inflammation. And looking closer at the data, you know, we know that there's a little bit of inflammation that tends to occur in pig stomachs because of the finely ground feed that's fed to pigs in commercial piggeries. But eating the GM feed took that level of inflammation and it boosted it up to the severe level. So if you compare the amount of severe stomach inflammation you get in pigs fed non-GM food versus the GM food, there is a statistically significantly higher amount of severe stomach inflammation in the GM-fed pigs. And if your listeners are interested in actually having a look to see what we mean by severe stomach inflammation, there is a website that's been set up called gmojudycarman.org, and you can go there and you can see the pictures that we're talking about. Basically, a normal stomach should have a slight sort of beigey look to it. Severe stomach inflammation, almost the entire internal surface of the stomach is bright red.
Yeah, I saw that this morning on your website. Now, so what Judy alluded to something. So as a farmer, as a natural kind of guy, I guess she's saying that when you feed any kind of feed, which is maybe an unnatural diet other than just let them forage in the forest, I guess that's what pigs do, I don't know, you're going to get some inflammation just because this isn't really their natural diet, corn and soy? Or did I understand that right?
The potential is there if the particle size of the feed is too fine. And we were cognizant of this, and we have been for many years in the way we handle and feed our own livestock, and we were very specific in the process in which the feed was ground for both groups. It was the same, and we did everything we could with the equipment we had to prevent that real powdery content of the mixture of the feed.
Yeah, you would think if it's powdered up, it'd be easier to digest, but I guess just the opposite.
Well, the 700 microns is the ideal size for absorption, and of course that's pretty small, and the uptake and utilization is ideal at that, but then getting it to that point, it's not hard to
You got to get you back on your phone. You're fading.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's important that you don't go beyond that. You can generate powder, and we were very careful in how we did it so that that didn't happen.
So I'd like to understand a little bit more, Dr. Carman, about the statistically kind of idea. Give us an idea, does that mean that all of the GMO pigs had inflammation, or majority, or just give us kind of an idea?
No, it doesn't mean that all of them had it. What it meant is that if you feed a pig the GM feed, then overall it increased the risk that pig will get this severe stomach inflammation by 2.6 times. So the severe stomach inflammation was 2.6 times higher in the GM-fed pigs than the non-GM-fed pigs. And we also then did an analysis according to gender, and we found that the female pigs were 2.2 times more likely to get severe stomach inflammation if they were fed the GM feed, and the male pigs were 4 times higher. So it in fact had a higher risk, if you like, in the male pigs.
Do we know stomach inflammation and reproductive issues then what translates into affecting the meat? Or is that beyond this study?
We didn't look
at... Howard's probably best to answer.
We didn't look at that in this study because of the, the scope and the breadth of it would have been phenomenal with the numbers that we were looking at and how we did it. That's an excellent question. Is how is this affecting us? The initial concept that was the foundation was laid by the first true independent research, which was conducted, as you know, by Dr. Pustai, is the foreign protein responsible for the irritation and inflammation in the digestive tract? That's
right.
Question from day one. Well, the industry's so-called safety studies don't test the actual end product. If they do a test. Many times it's set up very short term, 7, 14, 21, 30, or at the most 90 days. And as Judy said, their numbers that they'll have will be too small. But the biggest joke, in my opinion, of how they set their studies up is they'll feed the protein that they're going to insert rather than the proteins that are developed as a result of the genetically engineered crop growing in the field and then the fruit of that crop being harvested and put into the feed and food supply. Well, Dr. Pustai did that same thing in his study. He took the foreign, he took the BT protein and he fed it with the regular potato and they found no problem. But when they had the genetically engineered potato that came as a result of the insertion of the foreign protein, that's when your true quagmire comes into place in my definition of how many foreign proteins there can be. And then what kind of confusion is that going to generate when it enters the digestive tract?
Let's see if I understand.
Yeah, if I could just expand upon that, if I could.
Sure, no,
basically,
sure, go ahead.
When the GM industry wants to test the protein, as Howard was saying, what they tend to do is they don't get the protein. Well, there's a couple of different tests that the industry can do. The first is a short-term toxicology study where they will get a small number of rats and they will basically get a lump of the protein, a bolus of this protein, and they'll shove it down the throats of the rats and basically watch to see if those rats die over the next 7 to 14 days. And that's the basic sort of toxicity study that they do. But the protein that they put down the throats of the rats doesn't actually come from the GM plant. They genetically engineer bacteria to produce a protein that they hope is the same as the one produced in the plant, and they'll put that down the throats of the rats. It's a proxy protein. It's an approximation to the protein. And there are a number of problems about doing that. The most important is that the plant is a much more complex organism than a bacteria. And once the protein is made, a plant can add things to the basic backbone of that protein to actually change that protein in the way that the body sees it. In particular, it can add sugar units to it that can make it more allergenic that the bacteria can't do. The other thing, of course, is that they're only feeding it to animals on one occasion and then watching to see if the animals die, which is a fairly crude measure of health, and only over a very short period of time, only 7 to 14 days. So there are all of these problems with this whole approach that the industry uses, these short-term toxicology studies. Now, sometimes the industry goes further and they might actually get the actual corn, for example, and feed that to some animals. But often these animal studies that they do are fairly short-term and they often use animals that are not really relevant to humans, you know. They might feed chickens, for example, the crop and see whether they basically live or die over a period of time. And our bodies are very different to those of chickens, which is why chickens are not used in medical research, you know, because they're just physiologically very different critters than humans. Now, sometimes the industry goes further and they might actually feed it to rats for 3 months, but that's the longest study that I've seen done by the industry, and it's only 3 months, which isn't long enough. We fed for much longer than that, and that almost twice as long we fed the pigs for in this study. And the other thing about pigs, of course, is that they've got a digestive system that's very similar to humans, and we measured endpoints that are relevant to humans. So the results that we've got may be relevant to human beings. In other words, the crops that we fed, in the combination that we fed, that might also be occurring in people. And I think that that needs to be assessed. We need to have some human studies to see if it's happening there too.
Huh. Has there ever been, I guess there hasn't really been human studies. I mean, you have to wait.
No.
You'd have to have control groups and people eat GMO and then they would die and they would check their intestines and the whole thing. So that's never been done, I guess.
That's correct.
Right.
And I mean, my argument's always been that you need to do animal studies first to see what to look for in human studies. And if you do see an increase in something like this, then you need to go and see if you can see anything happening, for example, in a surveillance system, if one is available for a particular condition in humans, to see if it's gone up over time. So, I mean, that is one thing you can do. But you see, no one's ever really gone looking in surveillance systems either to see if certain things have gone, you know, this is a bit of a, you know, government bodies, for example, haven't done that, you know, to see if certain conditions have gone up since GM crops were introduced. So it's, I mean, the industry says, look, what they say to us here in Australia is that Americans have been eating GM crops for over a decade and you can't show anyone who's actually gotten sick from eating GM crops. And that's the extent of the human study that's been done. In other words, nothing's been done.
Yeah, you would never, I mean, to be fair, you would never be able to make any kind of connection with any kind of diseases in our culture because, I mean, how could you? You just, you know, you know, without...
And that's what epidemiologists are skilled at doing, is actually doing human studies to determine if there's a link between exposure to something and getting a certain disease. So, and those studies are difficult to do. There's no doubt they're very difficult to do.
Well, just from a logical thing, after I read this study, I mean, I was always concerned, for what it's worth, personally, about giving my animals maybe chicken or something that, you know, that was fed GMO corn and stayed away from it. But after seeing this and after seeing this stuff on your website, it's almost like, I mean, how can you eat... How could you eat the animals that are being fed this? Because you don't know what's affecting the meat.
Yes, and
I mean, you just don't, do you?
No. Well, the other thing, of course, is that there's been an argument by some food regulators around the world to say, look, you can feed the corn and the soy to animals, and then people can eat the products of those animals, and there is no problem at all. You don't have to label any of that or anything like that because, well, you know, all of the protein is digested in the gut of the animal and it doesn't go any further. Well, they're wrong. I mean, there have been a number of studies now that show that the GM protein that the animal ate that came from the plant, you can find it in the tissues of the animal. In fact, there was a study done in Italy where they took milk off of supermarket shelves and they tested it, and they could determine which GM crops the cows had been eating by looking in the milk.
Really? In Italy?
Yeah.
And there was the Aziz study out of Canada found the Cry1-ABBT toxin in 93% of the pregnant women's blood that they tested, and 80% of that was also detected in the baby's blood. So the industry's claims that this is all safe and fine and broken down in the stomach are obviously untrue.
And just to extend upon what Howard said, basically what that study showed is that the protein that he's talking about goes, you know, is made by the GM plant. It survives digestion in the animal that eats it, you know, such, and the people, the authors of this particular paper were actually suggesting that they might, these people might have been exposed to these proteins by eating animals that have been fed GM feed. So if they're correct, then the protein that appears in the GM crop goes, is eaten by the animal, survives digestion, goes into the tissues of the animal to go into the milk that the animal produces, which then is consumed by a person, which survives digestion in the digestive system of the person, to then cross, to go into the uterus of the human being, and then even crosses the placenta to go into the developing child. So this, if they're right about all this, this is how long-lived these proteins are.
And let's go a little bit to the reproductive. So scientifically, all you know is that the uterus in the GMO-fed animals were 25% heavier. Is that correct?
Mm. That's correct, yes. Yeah. And that was a statistically significant finding.
But anything else you can say about that is speculation, what that means.
Well, yes, it requires... Yeah, it requires taking tissue samples and putting them in wax blocks and slicing them really finely, mm-hmm. and staining them and looking at under a microscope.
But yep. Something's going on with that 25%. I mean, what do you speculate? And this is just speculation. What is your theory? Is it inflammation of the uterus?
Well, it could actually be inflammation in the uterus. Well, I've got a list here from the paper of things that it could be. It might reflect endometrial hyperplasia or carcinoma, endometriosis, endometrosis, adenomyosis, inflammation, a thickening of the myometrium, or the presence of polyps. So all of these things are not possible. Conditions that you'd really would like to have. Yeah, they're possible. And it can really only be determined what's going on by actually looking at the tissues under a microscope.
Yeah. So, Howard, since 97, anecdotally, with your work with the farmers and all of that, have you seen reproductive issues that you can visibly see with less fertility, et cetera?
Yes, and it's been, depending on the varying event of corn, for one example, one of the first incidents we saw was in Nebraska. The gentleman raised his first BT corn. He had that in one grain bin and his conventional corn in his other bin. And when he fed the BT corn to his sows during conception, he did it back and forth twice before he discontinued the use of that BT corn in the sow's ration. But the one time he saw a 30% reduction in conception rate of the sows, and the next time he saw a 70% reduction rate in the conception of the sows. You go to a customer in South Dakota who, again, had excellent record keeping. When they fed the BT corn to their sows, they had data over a one-year time period, and they saw a 1.6 pig per liter drop in the number of pigs that were born, and they also saw a reduction in the actual weight of the pigs when they were born. You go to another incident that happened in southwest Iowa, and they had something called pseudo-pregnancies, and they actually had a false pregnancy. They seemed to conceive, and they would go full term through the gestation cycle, and all that they would deliver upon maturity would of the pregnancy would be a little pocket of water and afterbirth. And when that story went in, that story was written up in the Farm Bureau Spokesman. After that gentleman's story came out, he started receiving phone calls from four or five different farmers in that surrounding county's area, and they all were having the same problems with that same BT corn, but somehow the university couldn't find any possible connection between that BT corn and the problem. But when they quit feeding that corn, the problem went away. So, and you fast forward to today, and the one very well-run operation that we have given advice to, they took the steps to plant the non-GMO corn and put it into their rations. And when they, and just, you can't find better record keeping than what they had or have. When they, the day they started feeding the non-GM corn in their nursery ration, they saw their antibiotic use drop by 85%. They were very astute in going through and given the necessary injectable antibiotics as the pigs exhibited symptoms of needing them. And when they called me to tell me about this, he says, well, we've had some things happen that we're just kind of scratching our head on how this is working. Can you have time to ask questions? And I says, sure, but I want to ask you a question first. I says, when you switched, did the pigs' energy level increase, and did you see an improvement in their stools? Which means, you know, monitoring the stools of the animal will tell you a lot about the health of the animal. And anybody who knows animal husbandry well will tell you that's very important to watch. And he said, well, absolutely. He says, how did you know that? Well, that was something that we have witnessed consistently. There's a better contentment level of the animals. They're just everything about it is much improved as far as the overall health of the animal when they're on the non-GM feeds.
Dr. Carman, is it possible, I want to ask you, I'm really, really concerned about people eating chickens or eggs or meat or anything from the animals being fed GMO grain, right? And Is there going to be a way in the future to know exactly and dogmatically whether or not there's an issue there, or are there always going to be kind of unknowns where we just don't know? In other words, knowing what I know, I would have to say logically, I have no idea. I'm going to choose not to do this, but I have no idea if they could really affect myself or my family or my children or my great-grandchildren.
Indeed, and you don't know. That's correct.
Is that fair?
I mean, there are some studies, but there are some studies that could be done to determine if actually eating the meat from these animals might actually cause harm in the person that eats them. But there's something that I'd like to say, and that is, to me, the greatest problem is actually in people eating the food directly, eating the crops directly. So at the moment, you know, if you feed it to an animal and then you eat the meat and milk and stuff from the animal, at least it's gone through another animal's digestive system before it gets to you. Whereas if you eat the corn directly and the soy directly and the, you know, cottonseed oil directly and various things like that, then you're getting it directly into your body.
Just like the pigs did in
the
study.
Risk.
Yeah. So you say
exactly. So you become a pig. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's,
and there is a lot of corn and soy used in the United States, and it's not just, you know, eating tacos or things like that that you might actually eat that have got a lot of corn or maize in them. But it's the fact that these things get purified into an awful lot of different things.
Sure,
so,
sure.
You know, corn and soy, they end up as thickeners, and you get, it's a bit late at night here, I'm saying.
Well, that's okay, but just consider the high-fructose corn syrup in the pop, right?
Yeah.
The high-fructose corn syrup in the pop is a good example in all the drinks that people do. That's all GMO corn.
Yes. It usually is in the States, yes.
Yeah.
The majority of the soy and corn that you guys eat over there is GM.
Yeah.
By far the majority is like 90% or something like that.
So that's the bigger takeaway than the idea of the animals and eating the animals for you right now. Do you feel the same way, Howard, that this study is more indicative as the real hazards of humans eating these grains?
Well,
or both?
Okay, I get the luxury, I guess, to speculate a little more because I'm not a scientist. I would ask the question, what's going on with the health of the children in our country? You take a country like Japan, and their attitude towards GMOs was, no, we're not going to accept it. We're going to watch what happens to the children in the United States for the next 20 years. And what's happening? You look at the very well done article that Dr. Swanson put together, where she looked at the introduction, adaptation, implementation, and use of genetically modified crops and the increased use of glyphosate as a direct result of the genetically modified crops. And then she took the statistics from the CDC and looked at all the varying increases of a host of different diseases that are all autoimmune related in our country, and also looked at the increased food allergy problems. You can just, there's better than a 90% accuracy of the same trend of the adaptation of the GMO crops and the increase in these diseases. Now, the industry will say, well, that don't mean anything. Well, I'll tell you what, it means something to the mothers who take the GMOs completely out of their children's diet, and they're 100% of the time those children's health improves. And, you know, Dr. Pustai made the comment one time, you know, how much of a guinea pig do you want to be in consuming the GMO? And that's basically what's happening. There is an experiment going on, but it's uncontrolled and undocumented. And sadly to say, the the unsuspecting and unknowing consumers in our country are the guinea pigs in the experiment that the GM industry is forcing upon them by the alteration of the food supply.
And not to get too spooky on you all, but I can see what's going on now worldwide with the amount of pressure and the amount of power with the agribusiness and the GM. The G8 is going on right now with President Obama, and they're doing this new, another level of free trade, which is happening right now in whatever, wherever that's going, Ireland. And one of these whole ideas of this free trade that I've read about is they are going to convince everybody to lower these standards, and they're going to say to Europe, if you want to do this whole free trade thing, it's not fair that you don't like these GM foods, because if we're going to do the free trade thing, everybody's got to go down to the lower denominator. Have you all been following this? I mean, this worldwide, these people are not going to stop. You know, they are pushing this stuff big time.
They're going to try to shove it down everybody's throat.
Worldwide, massively.
But at the end of the day, what's the final deciding factor? If the consumer won't buy it,
that's
won't
right.
eat it,
that's
where
right.
are they going to do with it? Where that's, are they going to sell it?
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's why labeling is going to be so important. But, boy, that's going to be tough to get done. You have labeling in Australia, Dr. Carmen?
Yes, and we've had it for years.
Really?
Yep. And, absolutely. I mean, I complain about the quality of our labeling laws over here not being good enough, but at least we have some.
You got some.
United States, you don't have any. And I find that impressive because, as somebody who's outside of your country, you know, we hear your country sort of talk about, you know, democracy around the world, et cetera, and, individual freedom and the right to know and all that sort of stuff. And yet, American citizens have got no way of choosing whether they eat GM or not. They've got no rights when it comes to eating GM or not. It's I would have thought it was a fairly basic democratic right to choose to eat, you know, to have a choice about what you put in your mouth. And yet, American citizens, you just don't have it.
Well, Dr. Carmen, the unfortunate thing is these huge agribusinesses, they are the government. You know, they are the FDA. They are. I know this sounds kind of harsh, but they are the USDA. It's been proven. They are the EPA. There's nobody looking out for the American consumer in our government. It's just not happening. So it's a big problem.
Will Rogers made the statement when he was alive that we had the best government that money can buy.
Sure.
I wonder if he was alive today if he might alter that statement just slightly to say, we have the worst government money can buy?
It's obvious, Howard, and there's no secrets. Most people know it, you know. There's more awareness of it in people around the country looking in, like Dr. Carmen, than, God love most Americans, they don't know it, you know, because they don't do the research, and it's very challenging. Well. So I guess, Are we okay then, eating organic? I mean, I don't want to get too spooky, but what about all this drift and stuff like that? I mean, boy.
The best defense is a good offense, and the more clean, nutrient-dense foods that you can consume, and the non-GMO labeling project, there's evidence, strong evidence. There's no question that organic that's produced with maximum nutrient density will be the best. But there's also, from the evidence from the different mothers and the different doctors, and purging that diet as much as possible with getting rid of the sources of GMO, and then the big attention that needs to be paid is to the use of good probiotic natural food products, yogurts, your fermented vegetables, and they're, again, all produced as nutrient dense as possible. The best offense is, or the best defense, a good offense.
Sure, yeah. And then vote with your vote with your pocketbook and just don't buy this stuff if you don't know what it is. And well, Dr. Carmen, thanks you so much for staying up late there in Adelaide.
Yes, it's 12:30 in the morning here.
I know it is. I know it is. And an email wants to know if you've made any YouTube videos with lectures, pictures, so that we may share with friends.
The thing to do really is to go and find the gmojudycarmen.org website.
Okay.
Some people set that up. I didn't actually set it up. Some people have set it up, but I gave them some pictures of, you know, pig stomachs and things like that. So you can actually see what we mean about the level of information. You can. There's a picture there of Howard and I at the autopsy table with some nice big intestines of pigs there on the table.
Yeah, pictures of pigs.
And some... Yeah, and we got other documents as well. So we've got a copy of the paper that we've been talking about. A copy of that's there for anyone to download. And as we've come under fire by members of the GM industry, we're also posting our rebuttals on that site too. So they say all sorts of interesting, rather interesting things about the study.
That was my final question. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. That was my final question. What kind of reaction have both of you had, just in short, of the reaction to this study? First with you, Dr. Carmen, have you received a lot of reaction to this study released a week ago tomorrow?
Yes, I've got hundreds of emails. It seems to have gone viral really quite quickly, and I've had emails from people around the world. There have been a number of news items in newspapers around the world about this, and it's just been quite remarkable. The GM industry, of course, has come out fighting, and they're saying things about the study that simply are not true. So we are putting the rebuttals to those on the website if people are interested in actually having a look at them.
What are they saying about the study that is not true?
Well, a lot of rubbish, really.
Okay.
They're trying to allege that the results aren't real. They're trying to say that the statistics were not properly done, and that the results are basically just artifact. They're coming up with all sorts of interesting things. Fairies at the bottom of the garden kind of interesting stuff. They're trying to say that it must be because the female pigs were all in estrus together, which is just sort of like, you know, women get their period. Well, that kind of situation in a pig, you know, that must have been the condition that caused the uteri to increase in weight by 25%. No, sorry. You know, with the way that we conducted the study, there was no way on earth that could have caused the problem. So, so they're just doing stuff like that. I mean, I put on my scientist hat and just look at the comments and just find them really interesting.
Yeah. And finally, any official response from Monsanto on this? Or do they dare?
Yeah, Monsanto came out with a rebuttal of the study, and we've put our rebuttal to their rebuttal on the website. So you can read with interest what they've said and how they're completely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to add the most interesting comment I thought I heard from them was from the reporter at the Chicago Tribune, or it was actually from a person in the biotech industry. They says, well, we've done feeding studies, and we haven't seen any difference in feed conversion or rate of gain. Why did they look at stomachs and uterus? And my response to that was, is not the major organs and the body parts of the animal and how they may be affected by what they're consuming important to these people in the biotech industry? Or do they just care about rate of gain and feed conversion?
No. Which is what they sell, right? That's their brand, rate of gain and feed conversion. Yeah. Well, Howard Vlieger, go ahead, Judy.
So according to the standards of the industry, that would mean that, you know, if you're gaining weight, then you're healthy. I mean, that's basically what they're saying.
Yeah.
And so when we've got such problems with obesity, well, obesity is not a problem according to that sort of logic that they're using. Because basically they're saying, look, if a pig's gaining weight and it looks all right, well, then what's the problem? You know, what's the problem indeed? And it's the equivalent if you went to your doctor and said, look, can you give me a proper thorough health checkup, please? And your doctor looked up from his or her desk and looked at you and went, well, what's the problem? You're alive, aren't you? Therefore, you must be healthy, so get out of here.
Hmm.
You could sue your doctor for malpractice for such an approach.
Well, one could certainly speculate, and it's just speculation at the risk of piling on, but the obesity issue in our country, huge, and we just have no idea if this is not a component to all these kids eating these all this stuff. We just don't know.
Indeed.
We don't know. All right, Dr. Carmen, you can go to bed now. Thanks. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We enjoyed talking to you. Thanks a lot.
It was great talking to you, too.
All
Thank
right.
you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, okay, Howard, good job. Thank you.
Thanks for continuing to spread the word and help educate people.
Yeah, it's our pleasure, and say hi to everybody up there in Iowa. And keep in touch. Let us know what kind of things happen from here on out. We'll not stay far away from you, Howard Flieger.
Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. Okay, Chinese medicine. Oh, what's the Chinese medicine solution to GMOs? Coming up.
In 1933, the United States government ended the regular production of United States gold and silver coins. While most of these coins no longer exist, usgoldcoins.com has spent more than 30 years making targeted acquisitions of the best of these original pieces. We build portfolios for our clients to help them provide a diversified portfolio and protection against inflation. If you'd like some information on acquiring gold and silver coins for your portfolio, you can reach us at 800-878-2646. Learn about the best gold and silver coins. Learn about undervalued market segments. Learn about certification and appropriate pricing when purchasing gold and silver coins. If you'd like to learn about acquiring gold and silver coins for your own portfolio, you can reach us directly at 1-800-878-2646. 1-800-878-COIN. Call us today. usgoldcoins.com.
Previously, we talked with the owner of Synergistic Nutrition, Stephen Huer, and they offer the One World Grass-Fed Raw Whey that we have for you, and we talked about the benefits of One World Whey protein.
So you're talking about a superfood that has yet never been introduced to the marketplace, where when you get 100% usable protein into your body with the particular amino acid spectrum that it offers, you support muscle protein synthesis, fat loss, blood sugar regulation, raising glutathione and detoxification, and thus every aspect of your health is positively impacted, including your mood and your thinking.
Well, I want some of that. We love it. I think you will too. Click and order One World Grass-Fed Raw Whey on the front page, OneRadioNetwork.com.